I'm looking around to see if there are any relatives here. Lois, my wife, is here. We've been married 48 years, or will be in May, and I'm like a kid at a kindergarten needs to find mom to know that I'm anchored. So I'm anchored. Plus, I'm looking for Jessie Falk Cornelson. She threatened to... Where is she? There you are. She, if somebody speaks up and contradicts what I say, it could be her. Jesse and Albert were on one of my tours to Israel some years ago, and they were newlyweds then. They were quite disgusting, actually. We had to... Okay, there you go, Jesse. It is an amazing honor and privilege to be here today. For a number of reasons. One of them being that I am in a resurgence of connection to my grandparents. And like some of you others here as well, when Zaporozhye in Ukraine was attacked 3-4 weeks ago, then I recalled that my grandparents were born in the Zaporozhye region. Now, then, about a week after that, Michael phoned and asked whether I would speak here. And then I recalled that my grandparents on my mother's side, Jacob and Maria Wedel, were members at this church. I think Grandpa died in 57, Grandma died in 64. And my grandfather on my dad's side, Franz or Frank Unruh, was also a member here. And then wasn't, and then was again. That's a story in your history that ended well, by the way. If you want to know the story, I'll tell you later. Fascinating. So I feel like I'm walking in my grandparents' shoes here today. And what makes me emotional is that they came to Canada 96 years ago, almost 100 years ago, the primary reason being that they could bring their children and grandchildren and descendants forever to a place where they could freely follow Jesus. And my two grandfathers, I hardly knew them here, very somber men. I think they'd be pleased. They wouldn't show it. They wouldn't smile about it, I don't think, that one of their grandsons is speaking in their church. But I'm feeling it, so you can hear it. But enough, I'm happy to be here. The title of my sermon, and they didn't put the whole thing on, Turn the Other Cheek, and other modern midrashim. Midrash, is the singular form of midrashim, which is the plural form of a word that describes the Jewish practice. And maybe I should back up a little. I have a master's degree in Judaism and in the Jewish background to Christianity. Have visited the Holy Land probably 25 times. Studied there for 2 years, Lois and I lived there almost 2 years, and so I'm going to do a little study of Midrash with you today as we look at this Hebrew text. I have to give you a warning that the interpretation of this text may well be, I shouldn't assume that, but may well not be the interpretation of that text that you've ever heard. That doesn't make what you've heard wrong or what I'm going to say is more right. It's just another way of looking at it. And Midrash, the Hebrew word, is a description of the storytelling and biblical interpretation understanding of the Jewish people in studying the Bible. When one visits the Holy Land today, one sees layers of discoveries in the archaeology that one can see. It's all over the place. And you can see that there are layers of understanding and knowing. And the rabbis and students in Jesus' day, right to today in the Jewish school, they study the text to try to find out how much is there. How many things can we learn from every text? And that's somewhat of a contrast to the way we have studied in Christianity in the last 1700 to 2000 years. We have tried to find, what does the text say? What's the one thing that it says? And I think of a funnel. The difference between those two, and again, I'm not making comment on which one is better or worse. They're just different from different ends. In the Jewish way of studying the Bible, and they loved the Old Testament in ways that it was amazing in my experience, the Jewish people take the narrow end of the funnel and speak the truth into it, and then try to expand it to all the things that our mighty God might be saying. In Christianity, we've turned it around. We read the big text into the big end of the funnel and try to get that one thing out the other end. We have to do both of them, is my point today in trying to talk about this text. But I'd also want to say, especially looking at the Sermon on the Mount, that God invites us into a journey with Him more than a destination. We've often preached, get us to heaven. And we especially hear that coming out of pain and agony. Let's look to our next life, because this is so harsh. But when you read the Testament, the New Testament, especially through the Sermon on the Mount and through the actual words of Christ, He's inviting us into His kingdom right now. The Jewish Bible study, by the way, and I'm doing a long introduction here, implied vigorous argument and deep disagreement in the discussion. You cannot walk the streets of Jerusalem without seeing somebody arguing with someone else. You can't get on a bus without an argument with somebody about who gets in first or last. You can't go to the bank and change money. You can't buy groceries in the store without an argument about who's in line. But what's interesting, when Lois and I would walk to school in the mornings, which we did for a year and a half, we would often see people nose to nose arguing, and when we'd come back an hour later, they were having coffee together. There was a commitment to never lose relationship just because of a disagreement. Now, isn't that a novel idea? And so I would welcome you, and in my 37 years of preaching, I have welcomed disagreement. Bring it on. I love conflict. It's like a cup of coffee in the morning. With the promise that you don't kill me. Okay? And if you want some stories about that, you can ask Lois. She doesn't always know whether I'm really disagreeing with her or not, or whether I'm just trying to get a rise out of her. And so in my churches that I pastored, let's talk, let's argue, and then let's, if we can't end it today, we'll continue it tomorrow. Let's keep going. And if there ever was a time to learn how to live with disagreement, now is a good time. We've learned that in the last 2 years. Disagreement with respect is very much needed. Dismissing those we disagree with serves no good. I believe in the name of the Christ, in the name of Christ, and in respect of humanity. And if you don't remember anything else about this sermon, humanly speaking, remember this line: when we disagree with someone, we should be curious rather than critical. We've become really critical of one another, it seems to me, in our time. When we come up against divergent thinking, we should be curious rather than critical. Now, back to the point. To know that Jesus was speaking midrash, was telling stories and looking for more interpretations to add to the depth of the understanding, and he used midrash, storytelling, and divergent thinking in his parables and in the Sermon on the Mount, it's most helpful in our Bible study to say, what else is here that we can glean? If we see Jesus as a teller of the Midrashim, we open ourselves to a big God. Wow, he meant that too. A God of inestimable love and grace, a God reduced to the limits of our narrow human understanding, to add to what Pastor Steve said, leaves us with less. There's always more. So run with me, sensing Jesus as a speaker of Midrash, and let's look at today's text for a wonder. And that's all we want, a glimpse, a grasp, a touch of our God of wonder, and be able to say, wow. We've made a mistake in Bible study that think we can learn that it's all there. How many of us know our spouses completely? How many of us know our children completely? There's always more, and we're looking for more. I had Bible school teachers tell us that if we were not inspired and or even angered, but at least challenged, every time we read the scripture, we're not really reading it. We've domesticated it down to our own levels of comfort and ease. So, to our sermon. Let me tell you a story to set it up, an everyday story. Some years ago, I needed a new set of sunglasses, went to the Richmond Mall, we live in Richmond, to the sunglass hut, which was facing the food court at the Richmond Mall at that time. I went into the mall, there was into this little store. It was a very small store. There's one clerk in the store, a young woman. I told her I was looking for some glasses. She showed me a pair, and then she went and worked with two young men who were in the place who were more her age. And she was paying them a lot of attention and me almost none. And I kind of like attention. Plus, I needed the glasses. But she kept paying attention to them, and I called her back once or twice. She'd always go back to these two young men. And this kept happening, and I have a huge patience, but I was starting to lose a little bit of it. And then all of a sudden, one of the young men took some of the glasses that she was showing them, or had shown him when she was moving towards answering one of my questions, and he stuffed them in this little bag that he had, and he and his partner went out the door, running. Well, this clerk, young woman, high-heeled shoes, after them, screaming, into the mall, and headed down the mall. I had this $100 pair of glasses in my hand, and she was, and I was amazed at what was happening here. I just put one foot out and watched what was happening, because I didn't want to leave the store, because I didn't want to be a thief either. And she ran after these two gentlemen. They were running, and she was running after them, shouting. All the people in the food court were watching this, and the two young men, I guess they were rookies, were so surprised that she was running after them that they stopped. You know, maybe 3-4 doors down, she got close to them, she grabbed the young man that had the bag in his hand by one shoulder, and she started hauling him back. And I'm still watching, and they're coming towards me, coming towards me. The other one takes off, and she's got a hold of his shoulder with one hand, and she's holding the bag in his hand in the other and bringing him back to the store. And just as they are about at the edge of the store there, and she's going to move here, I move out and I move into the hallway for her to come in the door with him. And he pulls the bag out of her hand and starts to run. And he's now going to come right past me. My mother said there'd be days like this. I played hockey for 40 years. And the pastor of Fraserview Mennonite Brethren in Richmond disappeared and the hockey player came out. Without thinking. I've often done things without thinking. And as he's coming by me, I do have an intention, and this you'll laugh at this, but it's true. I was trying to hug him. So I went to get him like this. He was going by, and something, the devil... This should be a confession. This shouldn't be funny, right? And so in my attempt to hug him, I hit him on the shoulder really hard. And he stumbled sideways and then ran head on into a young man coming from the other direction who knew what was going on. And he ran head on into him, and this young man hit him 3 times, put him down on the ground and put his knee into his neck. And I was standing there. Pacifist Mennonite Brethren pastor, although I did the first hit. The people in the food court applauded. And I felt terrible. Of course, I first looked to see whether there was anybody from Fraserview there. But looking at that story, I could have done something very differently than that. I don't quite know what. But again, we work on impulse often. And I really wasn't particularly proud that this crowd applauded that we had violently put this guy on the ground. Nevertheless, we all had options, both of us, the crowd, the young men, the women, the young woman, myself, we all had options on how to interpret what was going on. And that's sort of an explanation of Midrash. We have options when we look at a text on what we do. And we're going to look at this text now, looking at this Jesus text for our edification, for learning and walking and talking with him, for letting him get inside our heads, letting him rub himself behaviorally and ethically and morally off on us so that we can fully follow him and be part of his love posse. So to our text, Matthew 5, verses 38 to 41. And this is out of the NRSV. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Of course, quoting the Old Testament. But I say to you, do not resist an evildoer. How many of you have wished something terrible would happen to a certain leader in the world these days? Do not resist the evildoer. I think at that point, Jesus had the crowd in his hands already. What do you mean? To the Jewish people in the crowd, they knew who the evildoer was. If anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your coat, give your cloak as well. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go also the second mile. Some of you have been hearing this text for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years. Help me out here a bit. I'll try to catch your eye and I'll repeat what you say, but one or two or five of you. Is there any word or any image or any text that comes to mind that you've never noticed before or that you've always wondered about? Anything grabbing you here? Do not resist. Did Jesus resist the people on the Temple Mount when he cleared it? What might that mean? Here's what I think it means, and I'll come back to it if we get enough time later. I think it means, like my mom used to say to me, just because he hit you, you can't hit him. But he started it. Doesn't matter. I think what he's saying is, do not let the aggressor set your agenda. Just because he hits doesn't mean you can hit. So resist, I think what Jesus is saying here, and again, this is just a minor part, but we'll come back to it. He's saying, don't behave the way they behave. There's another way. And now we'll look at the text in its view. Anyone else? Anything else that something you haven't thought of? Or? Sorry, say again. Okay. That's a big one. I'll come back to that, okay? I'll remember that. That's clear in there. Has this text been hard for you? Has it made sense about the way you see Jesus? My interpretation for this text comes with the help of Walter Wink. Some of you may have remembered the books Naming the Powers, Unmasking the Powers, and Engaging the Powers from the 80s and 90s. Incredible teachings on how to deal with the world. Walter Wink, he's passed away, theologian. And then Kenneth Bailey is a professor, just passed away now, two years ago. Was a professor in theology and a linguist. He spent 40 years teaching in Egypt, Lebanon, Palestine, Israel, and Cyprus, and has written a number of books. The most important one that I've used is called Jesus Through Middle Eastern Eyes. Upsets most of the text on it, changes completely the Christmas story and all sorts of things in his understanding of it, which I won't, of course, get into it. But he's really influenced me in thinking through this text. And then during my studying in Jerusalem, I had three rabbi professors. The university I went to in Jerusalem, we had team taught Christian, American Christian professors, and then Jewish rabbis who taught together in most of our classes. Incredible, some of the best learning teaching I've ever done. One of my rabbinical professors, He was younger than I was at that point. He was 27 years old. He had two PhDs, one of them in New Testament. He was an Orthodox Jewish rabbi who was the head rabbi of a synagogue, so he wasn't a follower of Jesus, but he was one of the world's top New Testament scholars, had 80% of the New Testament memorized. And when you asked him questions, even about Old Testament texts, he would answer quoting New Testament texts. And it was a phenomenal professor. He gave me lots of help in this text. Okay, let's exegete this text for us. I'm looking through these three. But if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also. Often in pre-COVID days, if I talked about this text, I'd get some unwitting 14-year-old boy to come and stand with me. We've, of course, had to keep our distance now, but imagine, why does it say right cheek on that text? If you could imagine two of us in a conflict and we're coming to blows, put it in the geographical context of the Middle East, the left hand is a forbidden hand, even in hurting. You only use the right hand in engaging with people, even aggressively. If I'm facing someone, how do I hit him on the right cheek? And some of you will have heard this one. This has fairly been a popular translation for a long time, or interpretation. It means I would either have to go like this or hit like this. My rabbi said everybody in the crowd on the side of the hill in Jerusalem, or north of the Sea of Galilee, where they believe the Sermon on the Mount took place, and I'll refer to that a little bit later again, everybody would have known when he said right cheek that they were talking about what's called the hit of humiliation. To hit someone on the right cheek, you hit with the back of your hand. The rabbi also said, everybody in the crowd would also know he's referring to a hit of humiliation that is the action of a powerful man, a husband, a father, a slave owner, a boss in a company. And it's a hit that is only administered, never to other men, to women, to children, and to slaves. And then Jesus says, turn the other cheek. So I'm facing the man, I hit him like this, and when Jesus says, so I've hit him on the right cheek, when Jesus says turn the other cheek, that means he turns the left cheek toward me. If I hit him again, and he's looking that way, we've always translated as just, interpreted that as just submit. Jesus says turn the left face. If he hits again, where does he hit him now? Middle of the face. All of a sudden, it's not a hit of humiliation anymore. It's aggression. He's now moved into the criminal level of physical abuse. And therefore, the person administering it, in most cases, will not administer the second hit. Jesus is giving clues to the people in the crowd, the rabbi is told me, on how to stop the hitting without hitting them back. And in case we go, can we interpret that way? What does he do? He jumps to the next. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your coat, give your cloak as well. Walter Wink and Kenneth Bailey and my rabbi said, again, the crowd would know if who anyone is to wants to sue you and take your coat, they would immediately know it was the money changers who had their little booths up all around Jerusalem and wherever Jewish communities were. The money changers weren't only there to change money for temple practices, but there were no banks around. These were men who had money. And if somebody owed somebody money, they could borrow from the money lenders. And the unscrupulous or the less savory money lenders would ask the people, when he lent them a drachma or 30 drachma, whatever it was they needed or wanted, the unscrupulous or the unkind ones would demand that the person who borrowed the money give the outer coat to the money lender, ensuring, of course, as surety so that the person would come back for their coat someday, and that's the way he would get his money back, with interest. But it was only done by the unkind ones, because the kind money lenders, and there were some apparently, knew that most of the people only had one coat. And if they couldn't find the drachma to pay it back that day, they wouldn't come back until the next day or a week later or whatever. They would not have a blanket, because their outer cloaks were also their blankets for sleeping at night. Now, Jesus says, if someone sues you and take your coat, and you give your cloak as well. You can look at all different translations, what they call cloak and coat and all over the place. My rabbi friend, and if maybe you want to cover your children's ears here a bit, have a much more earthy understanding of what was said there. And they said that in whether he was speaking Hebrew or speaking Aramaic, there's nothing about coat and cloak in the language. The English translators and the German translators and the other have scrubbed up the Bible to make it cleaner than it really was. In the Hebrew and the Aramaic, it would have been, if someone sues you and takes your outer coat, give him your underwear as well. The reason being, Jerusalem and the Middle East, the whole known Middle East at that point, is overrun by Greek and Roman thinking. They had open baths, the athletes ran around, the Greeks and the Roman, nakedness was common. People saw, the Jewish people and the other kinds of people around saw the Romans and the Greeks in states of undress commonly. The Jews wore clothes to here and to here, if need be. They were covered up constantly. They abhorred nudity in the same way that Mennonites did. So, again, the rabbi says the whole crowd would know that what's going on here is if Moshe goes and lends money from Guido, and Guido says, give me your outer coat, and he gives him at least half of his underwear, other people will come along and say, Moshe, what are you doing? Why are you naked or almost naked? And Moshe would say, Guido asked for my outer coat, so I gave him my underwear too. Nobody ever again would borrow money from Guido. And the practice would have to stop. And in case that's too difficult to get a hold on, he jumps to the next line. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go also a second mile. And again, I can't overstate it, how much the crowd would understand what he's saying, which we wouldn't. They would know right away, well, go 1 mile, walk a second mile. Roman soldiers, of course, who were all over the place then, they could force, they were allowed by law to stop anyone on the street and make them carry their stuff. And we see that as Jesus is marching to the cross. They get someone else to carry the cross for them. The soldiers say, carry it. It's a rule in occupied territories. However, in Roman history, wherever they defeated lands, they built roads and they put up milestones. Probably 50, 60 years ago now, it was found in the old archives of Rome from Roman days, so many people, countries that had been overcome by the Romans were complaining to the Roman emperors that they were spending so much time carrying the soldiers' stuff. And the Romans didn't want to have constant trouble, so the emperor made a rule to all the nations that they were controlling, the then known world, that a soldier can force somebody to carry his stuff to the first mile, but no more. If a Roman soldier is ever caught by his commander forcing someone to carry stuff past the first milestone, they would lose their job as a soldier and they would lose their pension, which was usually a piece of farmland in one of the lands that they had taken over. So when Jesus says, when someone asks you to walk to the first mile, start walking to the second, what happens to the soldier? He says, stop, stop, don't carry my stuff. And if enough people are doing it, no soldier will ever have the courage to ask anyone to carry it in the first place. and the practice will stop. And it is beyond a doubt, according to Walter Wing, and again, and my rabbis, that the crowd wouldn't understand. That's exactly what it was doing. And they were looking for ways. They were looking for ways to sort of handle the aggression that they were putting up with and to change the behavior. So, application. Jesus is addressing two issues, just exactly as I said, how to non-violently, without resisting in their way, to respond to the immediate situations in which they're caught in conflict and to shift the power if possible. It doesn't always work, of course. And two, how to lead out and to behave in such a way that society is changed so that these practices no longer dominate their life on the street. So, anybody heard those three before? What do you think? Can you live with that new interpretation?
Yeah.
Does it smack more of Jesus than just submitting? Jesus did submit in the end, right? For his crucifixion. But until then, he didn't. He walked away. You never knew how Jesus was going to respond to how people were responding to him. And this is the Jewish way of understanding this text, which I think we've lost in our Western world, although it doesn't hurt us to submit every once in a while in certain situations. One day when I was standing, there's a beautiful little Catholic church at the top of the hill on the Mount of Beatitudes, which is a hill that looks down on the northern end of the Sea of Galilee. It's probably 2 kilometers above the lake. There's this Catholic church there and a huge garden, and been there dozens of times. But take my tour groups there, and as students, Lois and I were there a number of times. But just when I was last there, 2.5 years ago, I heard someone shouting. And in one of the little gardens right beside this Catholic church was a Israeli Jewish guide. And the Jewish guides that go on all these trips have a high level of Bible, New Testament, Old Testament knowledge and history. These guys are just men and women, are just filled with information. And I walk by, and I'm used to hearing shouting in Israel, but he's shouting at this little group of old colony Mennonites. The women have the little white hats on, and the men have all got black suits, and he's shouting at them, and they're all standing there like this. And he's saying, "Why are you so passive? Why do you not understand where you are?" And they're sort of going back. And he says, "You need to recognize that this Mount of Beatitudes, the Sermon on the Mount is to you Christians what the giving of the tablets to Moses was to the Jewish people. Can you have some passion about that?" He says, "This mountain represents the way to your salvation. And I want to hear some hallelujahs and some crying." Coming from a man who's not a Jesus follower, right? Who's saying this is an important place. And so notice the areas of living. I need to get going, don't I? What's happening here in this text? And then I'll close. When Jesus says, "Turn the other cheek," and he's addressing the slapping of women and children and slaves, he's addressing domestic abuse. When he says, "When the guy wants your overwear, give him your underwear," as weird as that may sound, he's addressing financial abuse and or even poverty. When he says to them, when he wants you to walk 1 mile, walk 2, he's addressing military or any authoritative kind of abuse. And he's really helping the listeners on the side of the hill figure out how to address the abuses, the whole circle of abuses that they're living with, and finding ways both to somehow deal with it a little bit as it's happening, and how to also bring the kingdom into the wider community. It's massively rich what's going on in this text, if we can understand that. Jesus came to bring to earth his kingdom of God. Many times he said it was here already, but not yet. He held the kingdom as a mysterious but wondrously layered double world of his followers doing on earth as is in heaven. That's what he was asking them to do. We pray for that. When do we do it? And in that, he wanted his followers to experience the kingdom of his already in the midst of the vicissitudes of their daily life. And in so doing, we're bringing salt and light. Stephen talked about that the other day. Already now. Be salt and light already now. Jesus wanted us to know and to feel and to live the reality of his kingdom on this earth. And at the same time, look forward to its absolute manifestation in the next life. He worked both layers, both levels. Jesus carried these two realities in his hand and held them out for us in his thinking, his speaking, his being in the text. First, he brought them a strategy of shalom right on the everyday streets, which were often abusive. He gave them a non-resistant way to address the power differentiality and the mistreatments they faced. But he was interested always in the whole person. He's always looking after the whole person, feeding, healing, salvation. He was always interested in creating a new person, a new community, a new world, a new kingdom here and now and forever. His interest was in confronting the powers and principalities that the Apostle Paul picks up later and still run rampant, don't they, in our private and our public and our unshalomed world. He came fighting with the power of his love, which is stronger than all else. And secondly, he called and calls us in our following to chat the gospel he brings. And he called and he calls us in our following to address domestic violence and social violence and financial violence and all abuse of power, not with tooth and nail, hence he said, do not resist evil, but with intelligence and with courage, excuse me, and wisdom and truth, and prayer, and the Spirit of Jesus inside manifesting itself outside. He called his people to follow him, to live just a little in the creative way that he would apply enormously in dying on the cross, all to change the playing field of our human existence and to transform our eternal destiny. He could work both at the same time. Christ came to reboot the lost and broken Garden of Eden, and his Spirit continues to invite us to walk with him, to work with him, if we just will. He calls us to be participants in the world, to be his shalom agents, peacemakers of a new way in his name, pursuing a radical way of living in small ways and in large. And his call does not always manifest itself through a gentle, meek, and mild, passive grid. Our Christmas carols have given us this meek and mild view of Jesus, and he was there for a moment. Sometimes the Jesus way manifests itself through an assertive act of justice-making. Dr. Jackie Lewis, a writer, theologian that I just come in contact with lately, calls this manifestation of Jesus' actions as fierce love. She says, fierce love is rule-breaking, border-crossing, ferocious, and extravagant kindness that increases our tribe. And I'd add, increases our faith, our impact, our followership of Jesus, our living out the kingdom of God. And the only way we get to, on autopilot, behave the way Jesus wants is if we are steeped in our living with him so that we can move in. May these modern midrashim of Jesus touch us to follow him, compel us to fiercely love this world that God so loved that he sent his son, so that we would walk in the shadow, exuding his light to one another, to our neighbors, and to our enemies. those who would abuse us and those who love us and out into the entire world. Follow Jesus. He invites us, you and me, to a constant craving to be near him, to be like him in living, to live in his steady surprise. When you live with Jesus, you're living with surprise. Because that's the best way to live, a walker in his kingdom, already here and now and forever. Amen.